on the day after Christmas. Welcome on to the studio, too. I'm Avi Wolf-Benarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, it's kind of a fun day today.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, we are replaying some great interviews we did in 2024, and we're calling it Dinner and a Show.
I love both of those things.
Me too. And for dinner recommendations, food critic Craig LeBan is the guy you want to ask. He and a team of other writers at the Philadelphia Inquirer, they came up with a list this year called The 76. It's a guide to the 76 most essential restaurants in our area. And we're not just talking Philly. There's some great spots there from the entire region. Our listeners gave us some delicious suggestions as well.
And for the music part of the hour, that's the show. We have two very different genres. We're going to listen back to my interview with Adam Wiener. He is the frontman for Low Cut Connie. They're a cult favorite here in Philly. They released a documentary this year called Art Dealers. We are also going to listen to an interview that you did with the stars of Hamilton the Musical. But before we get into the entertainment, as promised, let's dig into some of the best restaurants with Craig LeBan.
The core food department, there's four or five of us, sat down and we started brainstorming, you know, just throwing names up on a board, like what are the most essential or vital restaurants in Philadelphia? And that's, sometimes it's a different question than what is best.
Best,
right?
Yeah. Vital is sort of different than best.
Yeah, and we sat down and we tried to come up with a list of, a big list of restaurants that reflect the broadest slice of what makes Philly delicious right now. In every community, in every corner, we wanted to represent every community in the city as much as we could because we were all Philadelphians and that patchwork is what makes us so delicious. Every neighborhood and the suburbs, of course, as well. And then we assigned the restaurants to a whole group of people. I ate a good half of them.
Yes.
Over the course
That's
of the
lot
time.
Of eating.
Well, you know, it, and you got to do a lot of eating to get a, to get to the gleaming sort of jewels in the bunch, right? Mm-hmm. You know, cuz a lot of restaurants have a great reputation and consistency is everything. So, you know, there are a lot of restaurants that people went to that I sort of expected them to have good experiences at. And they were like, it was not so great.
Hmm.
That's just part of the process. But that's the value of this list is that it's many people, you know, coming together, a lot of differing opinions. But then we went out and ate the meals.
We're getting a ton of comments.
Yes.
Because people are talking about their favorites. So I want to get some of these in before we get to some of yours. We have Alan who says, my favorite Mexican comfort food in Philly is found at Que Chula Es Puebla, North 2nd and Master Street in Kensington. Everything on the menu is awesome. Best thing is their flan.
Oh, yes.
Craig LeBan called it the best in Philly years ago, and it's still true.
I can still taste that flan.
Yeah, Que Chula Es Puebla. I like that one. And we have Maura from Ridley. My absolute favorite barbecue place is called Tanglewood Fire and Smoke in Folsom, PA. You can't go wrong with anything on the menu from ribs and brisket to crazy delicious sandwiches. But my absolute favorite is their buffalo pork belly
That
bites.
Sounds good.
That does sound good.
Okay.
So let's get into some of yours. And I wanted to start with something that really caught my eye in the fresh category. It's a place called Rosemary. And it is a makeover of an old school Delco tavern in Ridley Park. And I love these stories of like a generational change encapsulated within a restaurant. So tell me, do you remember much about Rosemary?
I know a lot about Rosemary. And Rosemary is a really interesting case because there's some news about Rosemary.
Oh.
And I don't want to scoop my colleagues, but, you know, Rosemary is a very ambitious restaurant in a part of Southern Delco that doesn't really have destination places.
Yeah.
A beautiful makeover of an old tavern, and perhaps too ambitious based on the news that's coming out shortly.
Oh, wow.
And you know, every time you put together, restaurants are living, breathing things.
Yeah.
So when you try to put your pin in a moment, you know, and say, here's 76 restaurants that are, you know, showing us what's hot right now, things change constantly.
Fast.
So, you know, we have to be mindful. That's just the landscape that we live in. I really love Rosemary. I love what they're doing, the ambition to sort of bring something different to a neighborhood that really craved it. But, you know, it's when you're doing something new in a neighborhood, you have to understand your demographic.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to sort of balance ambition with realistic business plans, and it's sometimes mysterious.
And Jeremy from South Philly emails, "I live across the street from Leviette.
I love that restaurant
at 11th and Washington. Mm-hmm. And obviously, this is the epicenter of Vietnamese cuisine in Philly. But I find this one to be the best. However, I'm always puzzled because it's seldom crowded. What does Craig think about Leviette? And I actually want to add to that because someone else lower down, I'm looking for the comment, mentioned Nam Phuong. Mm-hmm. That's Peter, which is also at 11th and Washington and is a Vietnamese place. So let's talk Vietnamese food, Craig LeBan. You had some really interesting Vietnamese places on this list and places that I didn't even know about.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we talk about looking at covering the broadest diversity, broadest slice of Philadelphia's restaurants, there were certain cuisines that were stronger than just so present than others that we had to have more than just a handful of picks. Italian was one of them, Mexican for sure. And Vietnamese and Southeast Asian cuisine is also so strong in this city. So because we have so many great restaurants, and you know, one of the part of the process was, you know, 76 sounds like a lot. But when you start naming all your favorite restaurants, there are so many other restaurants that are so great that could be on this list. And some of those restaurants you just named. Leviette is a restaurant that I wrote about many, many years ago when it opened. It's a beautiful little space on 11th Street. It's a slightly different sort of regional sort of approach to Vietnamese cuisine than some of the others. You know, communities come here from different parts of their origin countries. The things that I remember most from there are they had this fried chicken and a fish sauce, caramel sauce called Poppy's Chicken Wings that are so good.
Mm.
Once in a while we go there. And again, it is not busy for some reason.
Yeah.
But they've survived a really long time. So, you know, it's definitely part of the community.
Worth checking out.
Yeah, I've gone there so many. I used to live around the corner from there, and that was one of my go-to spots.
But you're across the street from, you know, Washington Avenue is this corridor of Southeast Asian strip mall businesses that are so vibrant and changing and
so
bustling. There's a lot of good stuff there, and we definitely had some restaurants from that neighborhood.
Yeah, you mentioned in the New Guard category, there's a place called Cafe Nan, Vietnamese South Philly. And one of the things I liked about this is that, from my understanding, is they specialize in a soup that isn't pho. So a lot of people know pho as the sort of the Vietnamese soup.
Yeah.
But I love when you put something on the list that features a dish that people don't typically eat from that cuisine. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, people from Vietnam eat that cuisine, of course. Pho, you know, pho was one of the first things that we got to experience in America as a, you know, a comfort food from Vietnam. It's omnipresent. Bun Bo Huệ is a regional, I believe it's central Vietnam, and the soup is rich and spicy, and it's got some lot of lemongrass, but also a lot of, you know, shrimp paste in there that gives it a little bit of fermented funk to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also got a lot of mixed meats. So if you order the Dak Biet style, which means with everything, you get the pig's feet and you get some, you know, tripe and tendon and cubes of jellied blood in there. And that is a very hearty, you know, so for me, it's a wonderful thing to eat in the wintertime.
And it's Cafe Nan.
Cafe Nan, but
And you had some other Vietnamese places as well.
And there was
another
restaurant on Southeast Street called Cafe Diem, which was always sort of known as a spot for Bun Bo Huệ. And Cafe Nan is a little bit of a newer entry. That's why I guess we put it on New Guard. And they're on the west side of Broad Street on West Passyunk Avenue. It's a mother and a son. And they make many other things. Their Bun Bo Huệ is sort of the reason to go, but they make a braised lemongrass chicken. They make a pho with a braised short rib that's incredible.
Mm.
Also, his chicken wings are incredible.
Chicken wings. And I never even associated chicken wings with Vietnamese cuisine.
Oh, yeah.
They're some of the best things on the menu.
Oh, you know, crispy chicken. It's all around the world. Everybody loves a crispy chicken, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I have to say, Craig, because you had 36 entries on this list that you talked about, and you have this love for international cuisine, it seems like. Not a lot of American items on yours, but a lot of international. And so I wanted to stretch myself right a little bit. And you had White Yak Restaurant on your list. It's a Himalayan restaurant. It's in Manayunk. They had Himalayan dumplings. I love dumplings.
Okay.
So tell me about this place. Tell me, because I need to stretch myself. Avi's been helping me stretch.
By the way, you didn't even know this. I ate there for the first time this weekend.
I didn't even. But
you
this was something that stood out to
gonna
me.
We're going to get a fresh review.
So before you weigh in. Yeah. Yes. Tell me.
Well, so White Yak is a Tibetan restaurant, mm-hmm. and they are in the Himalayas on the other side of the mountain range from Nepal. And we also have some wonderful Nepali restaurants that didn't make the 76, but were one of my favorites. I mentioned in a descent. but they both make dumplings called momo, mm-hmm. and momo are sort of like a hearty, thick noodle skin mm-hmm. dumpling, and they fill it with all kinds of meats and sauces that are varied. And you get, I love the, at White Yak, they do a sampler of momos, but you got to kind of go off the sampler towards the more interesting things. Like there's a firecracker sauce. It's like spicy and tangy. Mm. It's quite delicious. But what's kind of interesting is the Himalayan mountain range divides Nepal and Tibet. And on one side, they share some things like momos. But on one side leans towards India and the other side leans towards China. So the Tibetan cuisine is there's stir-fried noodles, there's hand-ripped noodles with kumini lamb soup called tentuk that I love. Mm. Also a great sort of, cold weather food, which you might expect from Tibet.
So I have to check this out because I love dumplings. Should. And yeah. You telling me, what should I get if I were to pick a couple of things to dumplings. Sample. Get the dumplings.
Yeah, definitely get the dumplings. This thentuk soup, which is the sort mm-hmm. of the mixed meat and spicy broth with these wide sort of hand-ripped mm-hmm. noodles. She also makes her own sausage. This restaurant is a love letter to Tibet.
Oh.
And it's in Roxborough. And I love, we part of the challenge and the pleasure of doing this kind of list is finding restaurants in neighborhoods where maybe they're not as many as we wish mm-hmm. there were. Representing it. So it's a really nice spot to go. It's a lovely dining room. Her husband's a contractor, so the building was like really nicely done. And it's a really pleasant place. And the chef has a very light touch. Everything's very flavorful, but it's not real heavy. And I really enjoy it. It's one of our favorites. I actually celebrated my birthday there a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And
if it makes the Craig LeBan birthday circuit,
it's just sort of homey and lovely. And she, not knowing who I was, but she knew it was my birthday, she brought over this little white scarf that's a tradition in Tibet to celebrate somebody's birthday. And she just wrapped it around my neck, and then I ate more momo.
I love it.
That goes to
and
the
then
vibes.
You went there and loved it as well.
I loved it.
Did you get the white scarf treatment?
It was my birthday. But I will say, they were very accommodating of a child who was not having a good time. So they were very lovely people there. Briar emailed us. I think Briar's coming for your job because this is a great email. Mm-hmm. Briar says, spicy noodles in Chinatown, that's spice-C, is essential. It has the best hand-drawn noodles in the city, along with one of Philly's most hidden treasures, an extraordinary five-spice marinated egg that comes floating in your spicy, unctuous soup like a fragrant jewel, and a vat of pickled veggies on the table you can add yourself to your soup. The dumpling skins are handmade and silken thin. So good.
Shout out to Briar for that great writing.
I don't want to talk about another one here, Craig. This is a Carol emailed, some of the more long-lived restaurants don't get enough play in the media these days. I'm thinking particularly of a Bistro Romano, which has lasted with great food, romantic setting, and great marketing. But I want to use that as a springboard, actually, to talk about the icons category. Like I noted, you put down Oyster House in Center City.
Yeah.
You did not ignore the classics here.
No. As a matter of fact, we have quite a few. We have quite a few classics, and I was really impressed with that. You have Oyster House. You have Villa de Roma.
Mm-hmm.
You have what is a classic? We have Vetri Cucina. Vetri's been here for 25 years.
Yeah, at that point,
I'm lucky to have been here long enough to have written the opening review for Vetri. When he showed up, it wasn't always a classic. But when you see these places kind of put roots and become really influential, that's really wonderful. But there were a number of places. John's Roast Pork.
Yep.
Yeah, I love
the Clam Tavern in Delco.
Yes.
I did not know
about that place. I felt bad. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard of it.
How about Sagami? We put Sagami on this list, and that was really tenuous because, it was a couple that was, they were the pioneers of sushi in this region there in Collingswood. In the 70s, they did sushi, and it was a married couple, and the wife died last year, and it was really tragic, and everybody thought the Sagami was going to close, and they rallied and they have reopened and they are on our list because, you know, you sometimes you don't know what you have until you lose it.
Yeah. That reminds me of a place in my neighborhood, Artisan Boulanger, which is a bakery, so it wasn't eligible for this list, I don't think. But they had a similar situation where the community rallied around the restaurant, the bakery, and it's a wonderful spot, and it's great in South Philly. Shout them out.
Yeah, and I saw Corinne's Place on there as one of the classics.
Oh, yes.
Love them.
One of my favorites.
In Camden, yeah.
My favorites. And she was named an America's Classic by the James Beard Foundation a couple years ago. Yeah, Camden's got a couple places on this list.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, first let me read some more comments. Amy says, I dream about the smoked chicken rigatoni at Crybaby Pasta. Holly from Cinnaminson says, West Philly White Dog Cafe.
I like that place.
Good cocktails and appetizers. I've been going for decades and it's great. Ellen says, great spot East Passyunk is El Chingon, a BYO with great mixers, guacamole mole, salsa verde, and ceviche is top notch. The chef used to be a baker at Park, and she also then shouts out Park and says, by the way, you could just walk in and buy a baguette. You don't need to go for the whole rigmarole. So El Chingon was on your list.
Is on our list.
Yeah, is on your list. Tell us a little bit about El Chingon.
Well, El Chingon is a fantastic, it is a Mexican restaurant. Let's start there. But it's quite different from a lot of the other Mexican restaurants that we have in town. Carlos Aparicio, the chef, was a baker, the original baker at Park.
Yeah.
She's very skilled with dough. So one of the core items at El Chingon, which is kind of an all-day cafe, you can go there for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, or brunch, is he does a lot of baking, and he makes these semita rolls, which are traditional to the state of Puebla, where they make a sandwich. It's like it's a swirl top, you know, sesame dusted roll, and they just pile the ingredients on traditionally like a milanesa, like a breaded sort of cutlet, and a smeared of like frijoles and a special herb that they put on as well, and cheese. And there's these wonderful sandwiches that he makes that nobody else makes quite like that. But he's also incredibly creative and collaborative, and is doing a lot of seasonal things. I think this summer I went back when it was soft shell crab season. He was doing these soft shell crab tacos, but the tacos had epazote, so there was a Mexican herb that the tortillas were green, the crab was crisply fried, almost like a tempura fry, and then on top he made a plum salsa.
Avi's drooling over here.
Green.
It was amazing.
Green tacos, soft shell crab. Wow.
Avi's drooling over here. I want to read a couple more comments from our listeners. Bob emails, our favorite restaurant, Alba, is in Malvern, PA. Some favorite dishes, Agnolotti del Plin and wild sea bass with mussels, potatoes, and leeks. That sounds delicious. Scott from Westchester emails, Seven Stars Inn, Phoenixville, and Stampede Barbecue in Montan. Both are beyond awesome. Mm. I want to point out something that wasn't on your list. And I say this because I lived in Wilmington for about a year and a half. And one of my favorite restaurants in Wilmington, Delaware, was Columbus Inn. And it's so delicious. They have this lobster, shrimp, and scallop fried rice that my soon-to-be in-laws were like, you need to freeze this and ship this to South Carolina on a monthly basis. That's how much they loved it. And they have so many delicious things. The service is great. Why wasn't Delaware or Wilmington sort of included?
Well, you know, we have a vast region that we cover for the Inquirer, from you know, the Jersey Shore to Lancaster, all the way up. I say my territory would go from Princeton even down to Wilmington. For the purposes of this guide, however, we decided to kind of stick with inner ring, you know, the counties that directly kind of ring Philadelphia.
Okay.
And just because it was such a vast territory.
Yes.
So we decided not to include Delaware restaurants in this list. That doesn't mean that we don't do other lists. I've written a lot about Wilmington and Delaware over the years. And a couple years ago, I did a whole maybe five new restaurants that were in there. And we didn't include the Jersey Shore either, which is such an integral part of our region. But we cover that all summer long. You know,
yeah.
So it's like, you know, again, 76 sounds like a lot of restaurants. It's not.
There's 6,000 plus in Philly. And if you add the rest of the region, I mean, we're talking so many restaurants.
There's a lot of great eating in Delaware in general and Wilmington, but we had to draw the line somewhere.
Well, I'm shouting out Columbus. And I ate a lot of times there.
I have to go for the fried rice.
Joseph says, I love North Third. Been going there for 20 plus years.
I like that place too.
Chef Peter is the king of soups. His mushroom bisque and all the others always use the freshest ingredients, and his tomato salads during the summer months are best. I've never heard of North Third.
Oh, they have the best, you know, orange. They have a blood orange martini that is so delicious. Oh. You could down
North
three
Third
of
is
them.
Fascinating. Woo. Because it was one of the original sort of gastropubs. Yeah. You know, 25 years ago, you know, these sort of corner bars that were cooking really great food helped put Philly on the map as a great neighborhood dining city. Mm-hmm. Right. And Peter Dunmire was a star chef back then at Rouge. He was one of the original chefs at Rouge, and he helped open Blue Angel. And he sort of found his niche at North Third, and in fact, your listener hit it on the mark. He makes some of the best soups all the time. Mm-hmm. I always go for Peter's soups.
Can I ask you, I love when a restaurant story intersects with a neighborhood change or revival story. And you mentioned this place in Bristol called Jules at Market. I think I'm reading that right.
Yes. I visited Bristol a couple times, and it seems to be, you know, one of these cute little historic downtowns that's having a revival. Mm. And there's a lot of things going on in Bristol. Among them, Dad's Hat Distillery. Actually, they have another name, but Dad's Hat Rye is made at a distillery in Bristol. And then downtown, there's a really great wood-fired pizza place, and there's a artisan cheese shop. And Jules at Market is an upscale sort of destination seafood-centric restaurant. And the owner started as a caterer. And she found this space, sort of like an industrial chic space. It's kind of a big open space with a kitchen that you can see, and it's sort of sparse. And it was initially opened as a commissary, and people loved her food so much that it has evolved and grown, and the menu has sort of evolved with it. And she's brought on some talented chefs to work with her. Seafood, had a wonderful branzino that was a crispy skin branzino over a burnt eggplant puree with crispy tabbouleh.
Yeah.
And just good. And their focus was also on sustainable seafood. Mm. So there's a lot of considerations about overfishing and that kind of thing. So she's sourcing her seafood responsibly and, you know, turning out it's like a lovely environment. And she's expanding. She just opened a place across the street, like a al fresco kind of garden. So a lot's happening in Bristol. I think we're going to keep an eye on it. It could be the new, you know, Collingswood of Bucks County.
And that was Inquirer food critic Craig LeBan taking us through the region's most essential restaurants.
Coming up next, Avi, we'll hear your interview with the lead singer of Low Cut, Connie. We'll be right back after this short break. You are listening to Studio 2. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Low Cut Connie is a Philly-based cult favorite rock and roll band. Their live shows are high energy, to put it lightly. Think sweaty musicians, leather, sequins, piano stomping, jumping into crowds. As Rolling Stone once put it, they're ripping up the stage. And it's all on full display in Art Dealers, a part concert film, part documentary, that follows the band on and off stage.
Even without chart-topping hits, the group has amassed a cult of loyalists and some pretty famous fans.
I got to sit down with Adam Wiener. He is the frontman for Low Cut Connie, to ask him about those fans like Bruce Springsteen, Elton John, and a former president of the United States. Probably your single breakout moment is being put on this presidential playlist and by Barack Obama. Do you have any of the backstory of how that happened? Or was it a total shock to you? And to this day, you don't understand how it happened.
Well, I did get to go to the White House and meet him, but I was too chicken to ask him. And of course, the song shouts out the South Side of Chicago, where Michelle is from. And maybe that was it. But we met and he told me how much he loved the song. He told me how he said, I like your style. I like what you're doing. You got to keep it up. And so I'll never really know how he scooped it, but it's funny that you bring that up because the music industry never really has given me a break, right? I never got signed to a label. I've never really had proper management. It took me 7 years to get an agent. Like, I never really have gotten a break in the industry. But that doesn't mean I haven't gotten a break, because people like Obama have become fans and elevated my music a bit, put a spotlight on it. And I've just found ways to connect with fans, listeners, you know, without going through the front door of the music business. I've figured out my little thing and found my click, and it's changed my life. It's enriched my life. I love my job, but I have done it without going through the music business. I've sort of gone around it.
I think popular press would describe you guys as a cult favorite. You're not on the pop charts, but you have a really intense following.
Yeah.
Is that a fair description? Like, how do you describe your level of sort of fame and reach?
I'm a cult artist, and I'm proud of it. I wear that as a badge of honor. Because when I was coming up, I was inspired by a lot of cult artists. Like, Leonard Cohen is kind of a cult artist, one of the greatest songwriters of all time, but a lot of people don't know Leonard's music. Tom Waits, one of the first concerts I ever saw, Tom Waits at the Beacon Theater in New York City, changed my life. I said, that's what I want to do with myself. But he's kind of the ultimate cult artist. Patti Smith never really had a top 10 hit per se, but she's ultra inspiring to me. So
you never aspired to stadium shows, things like that?
I don't know that you can aspire to that. It's certainly not something I ever thought about. I just wanted to get 10 people to show up to see me in a bar. And so the fact that now hundreds and sometimes thousands of people show up, that's great for me.
You were 31, I believe,
yeah,
when Low Cut Connie congealed.
Yeah,
formed.
Congealed, yeah.
and so there's this big period in between where you're trying to be an artist, but it's not quite connecting. Can you...
I was bombing. Just say it. You can say it. I was failing.
I think you do say in the documentary that you were bombing. And there's some footage of you playing these, like, you know, empty high school auditoriums and things like that.
Yeah, divey bars. You know, if there was five drunk people in a bar, was like a pretty common setup for me for doing a show in my 20s.
Of course, the natural question, why were you still doing it at that point? Well, hadn't you moved on?
I kind of had moved on in that I stopped thinking, well, I'm going to have a career doing this. But I've always felt called to be a performer and a musician. So I was never going to stop being an artist. But I didn't think it would happen for me. So, of course, the minute that I stopped trying to have a career and I took a full-time job teaching, then it did happen.
And so for the, let's say, the about decade before that.
Yeah.
You had been trying to make it as a musician and then doing hustles on the side to make a living. Could you just talk a little bit about the types of jobs you were doing?
Oh, man. Well, I did so many jobs, and I did so many jobs poorly. I was a secretary in a doctor's office for 2.5 years, and I was terrible. Terrible.
Losing the files, people's numbers.
Exactly. Yeah. I worked in a vintage clothing store. I was a piano tuner. I did phone banking and phone solicitation. I was a personal assistant to a doctor, and I also had my little music hustle gigs, right? I always played piano in New York City in Italian restaurants, in gay bars. I played piano for karaoke nights, dance shows, old age homes. And I don't want people to think that I hated all these jobs. I mean, I really enjoyed it, meeting people, seeing how people live, and seeing if there was a way that I could fit in somewhere with my music. You know, the dream was always to play my own songs, but I don't know that I actually truly believed I was going to succeed doing that.
How do you think that decade or so of odd jobs and little gigs shows up in your music today?
It's in all of my songs. So I got a song called Private Lives. Private Lives just talks about, you know, how a lot of people we know, they've got their work life, and then they've got their personal life. So some people are teachers, cops, firemen, radio DJs, whatever they do. And then at night, it's a whole other ballgame, and they get to be their sort of true selves. I'm fascinated by that, how people live and how they find joy in life. So I think those years really refocused me and my writing on, you know, people on the edges, people that don't get the spotlight too frequently, if you know what I mean. Everyday people.
It's sort of like a updated and slightly tilted version of the Billy Joel Piano Man idea, that the guy at the piano kind of has this interesting view into society that the rest of us maybe don't have, because you're sitting there at the keys and you're observing and you're meeting, and I guess people maybe feel liberated to talk to you.
150%. Being a piano player is like being a psychologist, you know. You know, you sit there, people gather around you, they lean their arms on a piano, they look into your eyes, they listen to you play, and they start telling you their life story. And for all those years that I was playing piano in gay bars, man, I heard some real sad stories, hysterical stories, and I learned about people, how people live, what makes them tick. And my job was to make them feel good, make them hear that one song that they want to hear that makes them cry, makes them laugh, whatever. You know, I used to play sad ballads, and then somebody'd say, play one of your cowboy songs, which meant play some Elvis or something. Yeah. You know? And now it's amazing because I get to sing my songs about people for those people.
Let's talk about your style. I read that you don't play rock, you play rock and roll.
Yeah.
Is that right?
100%.
Explain the distinction as you see it.
Well, rock and roll moves your body. Rock and roll is music you can dance to and you feel something, right? And rock and roll in its essence is rooted in rhythm and blues. And I've always loved music that I can feel in my bones. It's got soul, it's got rhythm, it moves me, it's got a spirit to it. And a lot of rock that came after the initial rock and roll boom, you know, it's like each version of it, like hard rock, acid rock, metal, math rock, indie rock, it gets a little further away from those roots in each iteration. And I'm old school. I love that music that I feel in my bones. When I sing words, I'm sincere, which sincerity and conviction are not in fashion in rock music these days. I've never been cool.
Never
claimed to be cool. I just want to be make music that resonates with people and moves them. So rock and roll is how I describe it, because, you know, it's edgy, but it's got the roll. It's got that feel to it.
Do you feel like you are in the act of preserving something, keeping something alive, whether you call that thing rock and roll or something else? Do you feel like part of your purpose in what you do is preserving this original thing that like you said, has evolved to some other place?
I do. In fact, I have a song called Revolution Rock and Roll. And I say in that song, preaching to the choir, jump into the fire, and if I don't preserve it, then I don't deserve it. You know, the bridges that I came across, the people that have inspired me, all the way back to Little Richard and James Brown and Tina Turner, these were geniuses of early rock and roll who really shook up the world. They changed the world. They changed the way people thought. You know, you look at Little Richard coming out in the 50s, you know, a bisexual black man on people's televisions in segregated United States, 1954. I mean, it's still shocking. And there's something about rock and roll that cuts through the noise and kind of unifies people and opens their minds at the same time. And I feel like we've lost that a little bit in our music right now. And so I do feel like it's saved my life. As Lou Reed says, my life was changed by rock and roll, mm-hmm. Right? Turn on the radio. Woo, yes. And it saved my life. It's given me a path. I want to do that for my listeners and some kid out there who maybe hears one of my songs and says, you know what? There's a path for me. It's going to get better.
The documentary Art Dealers, it's a concert documentary. But one of the things I love the most about it is these little peeks into life off stage, and not just in the waiting room before the show, but I'm talking about off stage. Like the members of your band, you know, like one of them works in a soap factory and one of them delivers pizza, I think. And in a way, it's a doc about work.
Yes.
Why did you include those little snippets in the doc.
We're a working class band. And I want people to see that. There are a lot of concert films that have come out in the last few years, music docs, but they're generally about the top 1% of artists in this country, the tippy top, you know, and that ain't us. And Art Dealers is an antidote to that. I want people to see an image of what us working musicians do and why we dedicate ourselves to this life that for us is really does not bring us fortune, comfort. We sacrifice a lot. My band members sacrifice a lot to be out on the road performing for people. When they get off the road after doing a 6-week tour, the next day they're working at the factory or working, making pizzas or whatever they're doing. And we do it because we love it and feel like we're called to do it. And I want people to see that. You know, we glorify success and that's fine. But what about, there's a lot of amazing artists out there who will never, ever have true success, what we call success, but are maybe doing the best work out there. I have seen musicians and performers on the subway, on the street, in churches that could blow away so many current pop stars with their talent, and no one will ever hear them. My music, my film, is about the heart and soul of being a working artist, what it takes, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And it's not always glamorous. You're changing in a parking lot at one point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sometimes there's a dressing room. Sometimes there's no dressing room. Sometimes you're changing into a polyester onesie in a porta potty on the fourth day of a music festival and it's raining. So there's that, you know. I want people to see that. And it makes the performances sweeter. It makes it more magical because we go through that, those 23 hours of grueling travel, drudgery, all kinds of obstacles, but then you get on stage and it's magic. I mean, truly, truly magic. That's why I called it Art Dealers, because when I first started, you know, trying to be an artist professionally, this is the very late 90s. And in Philly and New York, these places where I was meeting all these older artists who had started working in the 60s and 70s. Actors, dancers, filmmakers, musicians who were so poor and they were still hand to mouth, paycheck to paycheck, and they were still working their craft. And it was so inspiring to see people that had actually dedicated their lives to their art, whatever it was. And over the years that I've been working, I have seen fewer and fewer and fewer people of that nature. We live in a culture now that we are all about followers. And how many followers do you have? Are you an influencer? How many streams do you have? Is it trending? Is it viral? That's fine, but it doesn't necessarily equate to great art. And it doesn't necessarily elevate the best things about who we are. But I'm proud of this film because it shows that we've been able to create a world of art. And I've been able to employ a number of people with my art and entertain a lot of people with my art, even though I am not at the top of this industry and probably never will be. I'm proud of that.
That was Low Cut Connie frontman Adam Wiener. I talked with him earlier this year about the film Art Dealers, which follows the band on and off the stage. It's available now on all streaming platforms.
Coming up, we'll hear from the cast of Hamilton. The hit musical came to Philly this year, and I got to talk to the stars of the show and listen to that iconic soundtrack. That's coming up on the other side of this break. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The critically acclaimed musical Hamilton follows the rise and fall of one of our nation's founding fathers. It blends hip-hop, jazz, and classic show tune style and was an instant phenomenon when it burst onto Broadway almost 10 years ago.
And when the cast came to Philly this year to perform a bunch of sold out shows, of course. Mm-hmm. You got to sit down with two of the stars.
I did. I talked with Tyler Fauntleroy and Lauren Maria Susse, who play Alexander Hamilton and his wife Eliza Hamilton. To start, I asked them to take me back to the moment when they first experienced the magic of Lin-Manuel Miranda's hit show.
So I had been a fan of Lin for a while. I had been following his development of Hamilton as he would share updates with it for a while. And so when the soundtrack finally dropped, I was a junior in college. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was sitting in my dorm room and I was, oh, yes, it's out. And I listened to it and I was just stuck on my couch listening to this soundtrack, like I'm sure everybody was, you know, when the soundtrack first came out.
Even though we started at the very same time, Alexander Hamilton began to climb. How to account for his rise to the top? Man, the man is not.
But I was just so blown away by, I think the first song that gripped me was obviously My Shot, Skylar Sisters, then Wait For It. I was like, this is different, you know? For me, at that age, to hear music that I am familiar with, that I grew up listening to, be on Broadway and telling this kind of story in this way with people, you know, that look like me, I was like, what do I need to do to be in this yesterday? I became a super fan of it for a while, for a while in college. Me and my friends, we were all, you know, let's do this song. All right, you to be Washington. All right, I'll be Burr. You know, we were just like those kinds of fans of Hamilton. And so it's just wild to have this full circle moment to be here today. But yeah, it gripped me the first time I saw it. I was swept up by it.
I first heard it. It was like my first year of college. And I remember getting a scene study of Helpless. And I remember being like, oh my gosh, I listened to that whole soundtrack backwards, forwards, millions of times. And I obviously, Eliza was the one that I was so drawn to and I'm so lucky to play now. But even getting that scene study, I was like, I wonder if I could actually do this. Like, I wonder if this dream will come to fruition. And here we are doing it. But I mean, to feel yourself represented in terms of like voice and style and genre is so seldom for Black and brown people, I feel like. And to actually feel that through a soundtrack is insane. We didn't even see it yet. So to feel that through a soundtrack, I was like, this is different.
It was mind blowing the first time I saw it. This was the third time I saw it this week, and it still was just as thrilling. And I noticed different things that I didn't even remember existed, like the last times I saw it.
Right.
So follow up question to you, Lauren. I mean, you had your aspirations set on playing Eliza very early on and then manifested it.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go from this is a dream I have to now you're on stage, full outfit, makeup, singing your heart out?
I always say it's like a combination of trusting myself and then also having a little bit of Delulu. Like you really have to be like, no, I am not stopping no matter how high that hurdle is. I'm going to jump it someday and it might not happen right now, but I'm going to jump it. It's just going to happen. If I didn't have the journey I had, I wouldn't be here.
You did Disney stuff. You were doing all
sorts of things. Oh yeah. I did the Cats National Tour. I did Aladdin. I did Six the Musical. And like especially if I didn't do Six, I would not be here. I mean, it really shaped who I am as a performer and also my confidence as a leading lady too.
Yeah, and you did a great job. And Tyler, you played multiple roles in Hamilton before getting Alexander Hamilton, the lead role here. Yeah. What was that journey like for you?
Yeah, I think from the time I listened to it, you know, similar to Lauren, I was like, I have to do this show. You know, I don't know how, I don't know when, but like, I have to be a part of this. Mm-hmm. It was a longer audition process for me. I think the first video I submitted was in 2015 and I didn't join the company until 2023.
Wow.
So it was a series of callbacks and dance callbacks and self tapes. And so, yeah, last callback I'd had was in 2020, right before the pandemic. And so then, of course, everything shut down, you know, so I didn't hear from them for a while. So I'd done other shows, you know, in the meantime, between time. But they call me and they're like, hey, there's an opening happening in the Philip company for the Lawrence Philip role. And that was the one role I had probably been in for the most.
And that's the son of Alexander Hamilton and Eliza Hamilton. Yep. Go right ahead.
Yep. Son and best friend.
If you don't know the storyline.
So I, you know, they were like, do you want to like, are you interested in that? It's yours if you want it. And of course, I immediately started bawling. So I joined the Philip company And then over the course of time, I was like, oh, like, I wonder if they let me understudy another role. I debuted my understudy of Hamilton the day before Thanksgiving last year. And so...
killed it.
Oh, thank you.
Did,
yeah,
it was did a good you kill time. It? I wasn't good, there. But
right,
I'm
sure.
Saying,
but it was a great show. Felt like I got shot out of a cannon. I felt like I blinked and it was over, you know? But I was very, very proud of like what I got to do, especially that first night. And it just kept growing from there. So then they asked me, hey, do you want to play Hamilton full time on the Angelica Company? And I was like, wait, oh, really? You know, so.
And so now
here we are. I said yes. And I left the Philip Company and now I'm with this new Angelica Company playing.
It's beautiful. So this production, by the way, has so many moving parts. Mm-hmm. The music. Mm-hmm. First, it's very energetic.
Yes.
It's a lot of lyrics. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. You got to memorize all those. You got to dance and jump and move around and wear these outfits. I would be hot, but y'all don't look hot, so I'm going to throw that out there. Lauren, I know you have your moments. I have some in my mind that I was like, she killed it right there.
Oh,
so what are your moments playing Eliza Hamilton that you just love?
I mean, I love Skylar Sisters in terms of it is so much joy on stage. And we're just like a little Destiny's Child, like
Thank
girls
you.
Group.
I felt that.
It's
I
so
felt
cute.
That.
I'm obsessed with that. Everyone's dancing. There's so much joy on stage. And I feel like in a show that has such a large arc and also does inevitably fall into tragedy, to soak in those moments of joy, you have to hold on to them. It also makes the tragedy all the more, you know, sad.
And that gender role, that gender dynamic. I mean,
absolutely.
The founding father, that was, first of all, founding fathers, right. it was just a man's world at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, some way, Eliza's story got wrapped into that. Mm. She started an orphanage, did all these things. And I just love that.
It's amazing.
It gave, you know, her a voice.
It did. I even met someone at the stage door in the last city we were in who had foster children and said when she researched the foster care system, she went all the way back and she was like, oh my gosh, I didn't know it was Eliza Hamilton. Insane.
Wow.
That's crazy.
That is a beautiful legacy that came out that I did not know about until I saw Hamilton. So I got to ask you, one of the things that stood out, and both of you mentioned this, is the diversity. This was a groundbreaking aspect of Hamilton as a musical on Broadway.
It's crazy. I mean, there have been other South Asian women who have played Eliza before, which is so amazing. I had some footsteps to follow. I wasn't alone. But at the same notion, we often end up being the only ones in the cast. So it's really cool to also be in a cast where there's people of all different backgrounds.
It's like 21 flavors in there.
It's amazing. Like, we were just celebrating Diwali and we're also celebrating the Day of the Dead with everyone. So there's so much to learn from the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
And when you fill your cast with a diverse set of people, the worldview of the show becomes larger. Mm-hmm. And there's more vulnerable performances. There's things you notice about it that you don't normally, because someone of a different background's in it and has attached or latched to something that means something to them.
Yeah.
And I think it's beautiful. It colors the stage in 5,000 different ways.
It is so wonderful seeing that. And so, Tyler, I know you talked about the diversity of this, having a role that you could aspire to as a young person.
Yeah.
What does this sort of mean for your career? I mean, because you came up in a time where this was available.
That's...
And there's people who were performers in the generation before you who would have loved such opportunities.
That is such a great point, because I've heard actors, you know, of the generation before me say, we didn't have a Hamilton coming out of school. You know, we didn't have a show to look forward to and hope that we, you know, could be a part of like this.
Many parts.
Exactly.
Many parts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is a blessing. And, you know, we're standing on their shoulders, too, with being here now, you know. And so I think being a part of this show now, it is all the more important, you know, for us to, that's why I'm glad we're touring. I'm glad we're going to other communities,
right.
You know, because, you know, seeing folks at the stage door, it's just like, yo, I finally saw a Hamilton that looked like me. You know, people saying that are like, you know, getting messages of like, man, like, I think maybe I can too, because you did, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, if nothing else, like, that is worth it to me, because like somebody in the audience is going to write the next thing, you know, somebody in the audience is going to do the next thing or be the next whoever because of, you know, what we do every night. You know, we don't know how what we do is going to touch people. you know, the people before me passed that baton to me and all those us, you know, and now we get to pass that baton as well. So that to me is the most humbling part of it all.
And I think it's also that it's a founding father's story, a foundational story to American history. And it's being told with such diversity.
Yeah.
Lauren, I mean, because that's the part, and you talked about Eliza and how she started, but that's the part that stands out to me. Mm-hmm. By the way, I want to ask you this because you mentioned audience coming up to you. Philly is special. You know, we consider ourselves to be part of the founding story of this country.
And
we
are.
Absolutely.
Absolutely yes. are.
So I just got to ask you, how does the Philly audience compare to some of the other audiences? I know you've only been here a couple of days so far, but does it feel different? Do they respond differently to different parts of the show, Lauren?
It's so amazing when you step on stage. You can kind of feel the energy in the room and in the house. You're like, you kind of know what you're going to get. And when, you know, Tyler goes on stage and says, you know, Alexander Hamilton, my name is Alexander Hamilton, and you have screaming, or you have immigrants, we get the job done, and people start hooping and hollering. It's one of those things where I was like, wow, we are just in the right place right now. Like, thank gosh, they are so responsive to the show. They contribute, they're part of it, and they love it here, which has been like so amazing. To do this show in that energy is beautiful.
That was Tyler Fauntleroy and Laura Maria Susse, two of the stars of Hamilton, which came to town this year through Ensemble Arts Philly.
Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager.
From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Thanks for joining us.
With him. Me, I died for him. Me, I trusted him.
Me, I loved him.
And me, I'm the damn fool that shot him.
There's a million